Welcome to Woke Talk Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Stanford. So as a physicist and structural engineer in training with Jacobs Engineering, I've made many connections with some bright individuals who are either working, studying, or self-taught and passionate about our particular topics of discussion. So this episode focuses on the ever so interesting topic of mycology. For those of you who are unfamiliar, a brief definition would be mycology is the branch of biology concerned with the study of fungi. This includes their genetic and biochemical properties, their taxonomy, and their use to humans as a source of tinder, traditional medicine, food, entheogens, as well as their dangers, such as toxicity or infection. This episode will be split into two segments, where the first segment serves as an introduction to mycology, while the second segment goes more in depth on the medicinal side of mushrooms with a focus on psilocybin and hypnotherapeutic treatment. So with that being said, we were fortunate to have come across some amazing guests for this episode, starting with Jasper Dejaneres. And Jasper is the Chief Education Officer of the Fungi Academy. Since he joined the Fungi Academy in 2019, Jasper has been on a quest to spread the magic of mushrooms with the world. So Jasper is truly devoted to everything fungal, from homestyle cultivation, ethnomycology, and fungal gastronomy. I would also like to recognize that Jasper is the host of Paddo Podcast, and Paddo Podcast is the first Dutch language podcast about all fungus heads in the Netherlands. So it's a nice, casual, and fun conversations of mycology, psychedelics, spirituality, and all the beautiful things in life. You can find Jasper on Instagram at JasperIUSS. Our second guest is Alan Rockefeller. Alan began his mycology journey in 2001 with fungi of California. And since then, he has traveled to various countries to collect, photograph, and study well over 1,000 species of fungi from Mexico and 1,000 species from the state of California. He has successfully identified many species of fungi that were not previously described in science literature and specializes in phylogenetic and microscopic analysis. His work has been widely recognized and published by reporters of many sorts, such as the Washington Post, Scientific American, and much more. Just in 2020, Alan co-authored a publication characterizing 5 psilocybe species. And let's just say, Alan knows so much about mushrooms that if he doesn't recognize one, it's likely an undiscovered one. You can connect with Alan on Twitter at Alan Rockefeller and the same handle on Instagram. Our third guest is Maria Pusateri, and Maria obtained a Bachelor's of Science in Biology and a Bachelor's of Arts in Dance at Nova Southeastern University in Florida. So in her spare time, she is also a professional photographer and yoga instructor. Just a fun fact, Maria and I are cousins, and she is the first family member of mine to join the podcast. You can find Maria on Instagram at MP03 or at MP03foodie and at MP03photography for her photography work. For your convenience, you can find Maria, Jasper, and Alan's social media handles in the description of the podcast or on our website, www.woketalkpodcast.com. So now that I've introduced you to the topic of today and our fun cast of guest stars, we are going to head to our first commercial break. But stick around, because when we return, Alan, Maria, Jasper, and I will be discussing everything there is to mycology and more in an introduction fashion. So stay tuned. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the first segment of Mycology is Beautiful Biology. I have with me Jasper Dejaneres, Alan Rockefeller, and Maria Pusateri. First and foremost, I want to thank you for coming on to the show. I am hopeful that today we can cure some mycophobia and get more people interested in the realm of mycology. But before we dive into the first segment, I wanted to grab some inspirational perspectives and ask each guest star, what inspired you to pursue mycology and what message are you trying to convey by doing the work that you do? Alan, would you like to start?
I started looking at mushrooms about 20 years ago. You know, I've always done a lot of camping and being out in nature. But 20 years ago on Christmas Day, which happens to be my birthday, I went hiking and there was mushrooms everywhere. And I was like, wow, these things are really mysterious. So I bet there's people out there that know how to identify these. You know, the internet wasn't super popular back then, so I didn't really have any connection to them. But I just started picking all the mushrooms I saw and taking pictures, and found out that they're actually really interesting. So I started trying to get the best picture I possibly could of every kind of mushroom I could find and figure out what they all were. And that just got me, you know, more and more interested in it. And, you know, now we have all sorts of internet connections with people that are all identifying mushrooms and everything. But what I'd really like to convey is that, you know, mushrooms are really cool and nature is super interesting. And when you go out hiking, just even just walking around your city, you're going to see all sorts of really interesting mushrooms, and you can study them and take pictures of them, try to figure out what they are. But I think the more people that we can get interested in figuring out, learning more about the biodiversity around them, the more people we have that have a good reason to conserve the biodiversity.
Yeah, that's great. Jasmine, what's your take?
So my journey started, I started buying them in stores on a frequent basis because I love the insights they were giving me. And also, like, to be honest, they were just a lot of fun. And it was a good excuse to go out into nature and explore the natural surroundings. And then I figured that, like, it's kind of expensive to buy these packages of truffles all the time. And my friend told me, oh, you know, you can buy a mushroom grow kit for like 40 euros and you have enough mushrooms for a very long time. And that's how I started getting into cultivation. And that just connected. When I saw my first babies grow, I was just like so full of joy. And that's where it kind of sparked. And like, I was really into the beneficial properties of psychedelics for a long time, because the mushrooms always felt like the closest to my heart. I started taking more attention to the mushrooms in my natural surrounding. I started reading books on mycology. I think mycelium running was my first one. And after that, a lot of traveling followed. So I couldn't practice the cultivation that much in the next like 6 years or something that I traveled, but I was always learning and I was always foraging. Yeah, I was always like wanting to share that love for other people, because mycophobia is also a thing I was raised with. Like, I have a strong memory of seeing an Amanita muscaria and I was like, oh, I want to touch it, when I was like 8 years old. And my mom is just scared to death, and she like imprinted this fear. And that's kind of the message that I want to get across, that these organisms, that we are with them on this amazing planet together. Let's not think that we're in this high castle as humanity. Let's give the respect and admiration and reverence to these other organisms that we're sharing this living spaceship with. And I think mushrooms are the archetype of connection and the archetype of that everything needs everything together. Like, we don't survive without trees. The trees don't survive without the fungi, and it's all connected. And I think that's what is really beautiful, the mushrooms.
I totally resonate with that. And Mycelium Running, isn't that by Paul Stamets?
Yes, this is correct.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot on Paul, and he's fantastic. So I, without even mentioning the book, I could feel and hear Paul talking.
That's a big compliment. Thank you.
Maria, what do you got?
Yeah, I'm right along there with you, Jasper. I'm completely all about the archetype of connection with mushrooms. My study of mycology only started like real recently. I just finished my undergraduate in Florida. There's not a lot of mushrooms there, but I'm from Pennsylvania traditionally. So as a photographer and somebody who has always been interested in holistic medicine, I've always looked into plant identification, different types of plants and different healing properties of them. And then once I started to learn a little bit more about mycology and mushrooms and how amazing that they are, you know, they're capable of so many more things than plants are, not to place a hierarchy on the mushrooms versus plants or anything like that, but I started to get really into the photography of them and then the research behind them. And more importantly, I started to integrate my background in biology and holistic medicine and start to understand how they can help heal us as humans. So I've started doing a little bit of research here and there myself. I definitely have a lot more deep diving to do, but I am super, super passionate about the abilities of mushrooms and how they can fix us as humans. And I want to go forth in the message that how we can use them medicinally instead of conventional treatments that could be causing more harm than good.
Awesome. This is really exciting. And like I said, the main goal of this podcast is to spark some curiosity for mycology, because mycology is such a vastly understudied field. And I'm sure you're all well aware of that, which is insane. And it's something that I came across just recently, and I'm absolutely blown away by it. I mean, what I know is physics and engineering, and I'm not going to lie, it's top three in things that I think are interesting in life. And I've studied a lot of different things. I'm very excited about this. So first, Jasper, can you let the audience know what mycology is?
So with Latin and Greek, I like to break down the word, and Myco, I think, has a root in Greek, and it used to be a word for sponge, or like sponge-like being, which if you see a mushroom in the field, that's like, it kind of has that sensation. And we think right now, you like grubby thing is a sponge, but before that, you didn't have those cleaning utensils. So it was more of a characteristic of the natural world. And the analogy is like biology, like it's the study of these sponge-like organisms. So in a nutshell, mycology is the study of fungi, how people have used them, what we can do with fungi, from entheogenic use to medicinal use to taxonomy, and so much more that we can discover, right? Like all these new fields that are coming up, like mycoremediation and mycofiltration and even myconstruction, like building coffins out of mycelium, and all these fields, I think, are part of mycology. And one of my favorite parts, like, has not much to do actually with the mushroom itself, is like mycoanthropology, but there's a different word for it. Anyhow, but there's so much that we can discover. And that's the cool thing about mycology, right? You don't need to be an academic to discover new species. You don't need to be an academic to make breakthrough innovations. Like, as a cultivation teacher, one of the most innovative techniques of the liquid mycelium in a homestyle environment was made by a guy on a forum, right? And I think, I don't want to speak too much for you here, Alan, but like, Alan has discovered several new species of mushrooms. And am I miscorrect? But did you go, like, are you a trained mycologist, or are you that beautiful word, amateur, a lover of mycology?
I just started doing it, so I've never been to college for anything.
Exactly. So, and that's the cool thing about mycology, right? You don't need to have to gone to an institution and get that fancy piece of paper that people pay a lot of money for to make a difference in this field.
Well, it really depends on what you want to do.
This is very true. This is very true.
Yeah, it wasn't until I started like fully studying like plant chemistry that I recognized I was so into it, because I do have one of those fancy pieces of paper, but at the same time, in order to study mycology, you don't really need one. But I wasn't certain that I was interested in it until I was in my study of plant biology. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. And it kind of opened that door for me.
I think, though, that even mostly in this country, we put a stamp on education and we kind of discredit anything that isn't institutionalized. You know, I've met a lot of people in an institution that self-taught people can do it a lot better in a lot of cases and a lot of realms. So I don't hinder education, especially self-taught, because when it's self-taught, you actually care. You actually are invested. You're actually into it. So thanks. Like you said, mycology is so vast. It covers so many realms. But I was thinking we could also carry the conversation over to the evolution of fungi and some basic taxonomy, because not only is the study of mycology vast, but so is the taxonomy of fungi. Over 90% of fungi are theorized to be undocumented, which is absolutely insane. And might I add real quick that the fungi has probably the widest range of species size compared to all of the kingdoms. I mean, fungi can run from microscopic yeast that we put in bread all the way to the honey fungi that can be hundreds of tons and span 10 square kilometers. Actually, the largest organism on the planet is of the fungal kingdom. And it is actually in Eastern Oregon. I'm not sure if either of you have been there or any of us have been there, but it is 2,200 acres in size and just about 2,000 years old. It's about the size of 65 football fields. So Jasper, I hope that was kind of a proper introduction to fungi taxonomy. So if you would like to build off that.
Ethnomycology, by the way, is the word that I was just blanked on, so that I wanted to share. And I feel like Alan might be the better person to talk about taxonomy, but I'm happy to run down the history of like the fungi queendom or kingdom, however you want to call it, a little bit. So as far as science knows right now, the first sediments that we perceive to be made by living organisms are about like 3.5 billion years in a fossil record. But the first multicellular mycelial organism is the first multicellular organism that we have in a fossil record and is about 2.4 billion years old.
Yeah, South Africa.
Yes, exactly. I think it was a lava sediment or something like this. So that already says like a lot. Like, they were one of the first organisms that really started the march of life on this planet. People claim that we have a common ancestor that they date back to about 900 million years ago. So that's when the first split happened between animals and fungi. And That says a lot, right? Because if you look at the organisms that are alive on Earth, we have two kinds of organisms. We have organisms that photosynthesize, and we have organisms that eat dead shit. And I've tried photosynthesizing a lot, and I'm not green enough, I think, so it doesn't work out for me. And so we are in the same category as mushrooms, because they also, and fungi, because they don't photosynthesize. They break down organic or non-organic material, right? Lichen can even survive on rocks given enough time.
That's actually eukaryotic. It's an organism composed of more cells containing visibly evident nuclei and organelles, and which is stated as the existence of Opus thoconta. It's a superkingdom that joins Animalia and the fungi kingdom together.
Wow.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. The difference between the Animalia and the fungi is that the fungi process their food externally, while animals such as us will process our food internally in a stomach.
Exactly. And just like us, they breathe out carbon dioxide, they inhale oxygen. And there's some key components, right? Like if you think of like a very primal animal that we have right now are insects, and the exoskeleton is made out of chitin. And that's the same polysaccharide multi-chain sugar chain that like fungi are made out of. So that there is a lot of similarities between us. And like in many ways, they are our ancestors and we are their descendants. Even the plants on Earth have such intricate connections to these organisms, right? There's like, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but to my understanding, there's never been found a wild plant that does not have a symbiotic relationship with endophytic fungi, which are fungi that live within plant cell walls. Most plants in the wild create mycorrhizal connections, which are mushrooms that interact with the roots. And this is where this whole idea of the wood wide web comes from. And they are such an intricate part of life. They are in the beginning of the system, right? But they're also at the end because they break down these complex molecules for the soil. And so other plants and everything can recycle what the organisms that have passed have been given us. So about like 360 million years ago, they like ruled the Earth, right? You had this mushroom or fungus that's called Prototaxides for a long time. They kept finding these massive logs way before trees ever evolved. And they didn't know what it was because they were 8 meters tall. And like the tallest plant at the moment was like maybe a meter high shrub or bush, until at one point they found that it is actually a fungus. And that ruled for like almost 100 million years. And they even found like some holes in it that they suspect it was made by the first insect. So they have gone through many, many transformations, just like ourselves, until I think the first fossil of like the characteristic mushroom that we know today is about 100 million years old. And
actually,
yeah, please.
I can throw in a little tidbit of information there. Actually,
sure.
It was found in Brazil just a few years ago that there was a fully a fossilized intact mushroom dated about 1.4 billion years ago. And it was, excuse my inability to do biological naming, but it's called Gondwanagarycites magnificus.
I actually was also doing some pre-research again on like dates and specifics, but like I couldn't find this 1.5 billion number anywhere anymore. But like, yeah, please, that's that's fantastic. And like the mushrooms that we classify that look like that are probably of the phylum what we call Basidiomycota. So if we think of mushrooms, there's actually two phylums within the queendom that produce these archetypical fruiting bodies, which are the Basidiomycota, which includes Psilocybe cubensis, the button mushroom, and most of the classical ones. But then there's also Ascomycota, which includes morels and cordyceps and truffles. And those are the fruiting body creating fungi. But you have so many more. You have Zygomycota, which are just the regular molds. And then you have a whole scala more. You have Glomeromycota, which create this really rich soil. And there's many more phylums, and I'm sure that Alan can go a little bit deeper onto the taxonomy of the queendom than I can. But that's a little rundown on how ancient these organisms are and how interconnected they are into this mycelial web of life that we roam in these blue dots.
Right. I want to throw some validity, because I know you talked about Prototaxites, and that's not really something that a lot of people are well versed on. And there's a lot of people that are kind of still anti-evolution.
Where are those people?
So Dr. Boyce at the University of Chicago published an article in the Journal of Geology back in 2008 that stated that Prototaxites are indeed giant fungus. Prototaxites actually thrived for 40 million years and which is actually 20 times longer than Homo species, which is us, have been in existence. And to come back to what you were talking about beforehand with how the fungal kingdom kind of have come about in the whole grand scheme of evolution, if you look at it, they came first and then the flora and the fauna came afterwards. And all it, if you step back and look at the total sequence of everything, what you see is that the fungi then create the flora and the fauna. And what it does is it pretty much produces for them. They do their processes. And then all fungi does is then just take in what they do and continue to spread and evolve and change and grow. So it's a beautiful process.
How you mentioned it almost sounds like they're a diabolical overlord. They're doing it for them. Although I see them more as us. That's why I like calling it the queendom, because it's like, I see it as a supporting organism.
Yeah.
They're supporting all of the other organisms. And in return, like if you are doing really well financially in a way, and you support everybody in your surroundings to also do well, you're living in a place where everybody is abundant, then you're going to have more fun. You're going to be more relaxed. And maybe when you run out of all that cash, you have some friends that then owe you a favor in a way, but they're still abundant. So you're still in that same area of abundance. And that's actually a really intelligent survival strategy. Just make sure that everybody's doing well. And in return, you're going to do well. Like that narrative is a little bit nice. Then the fungi made everybody work for us, in my understanding.
Yeah. And humans have such a very old relationship with fungi. There's the high ape theory that we don't really have to get into, but if anybody's interested, definitely look it up. Well, I wouldn't say theory, more like a hypothesis, but we've had a really great relationship with fungi by analyzing plaque on ancient human teeth. Scientists have revealed that the hunter-gatherers in Europe ate mushrooms as early as 18,000 years ago and spanning way even before that. I mean, the oldest mummification that we've found of a human is the Iceman, I do believe. Somebody wants to fact check me on that. But at his right hip, which is the most, the dude was right-handed. So the most important sign that you have in his satchel, he had mushrooms, fire starter mushrooms.
Yeah. So it was not the oldest one, but like he was the most intact one. And that's why his finding was so spectacular, because he was literally found out of the ice, like literally maybe an hour after he got uncovered. And he had like two mushrooms on him. He had like the Tinderconch, Fomus fomentarius, and then he had the birch polypore, Fomotopsis betulina. I think they might've changed some of these Latin names, which is happening a lot in mycology right now with more research coming out and more DNA sequencing and that kind of stuff. But yeah, really, really cool finds.
Thanks, Jasper. I really appreciate that. That was really great information. Alan, where can we find fungi in the world?
Fungi are pretty much everywhere. There's nowhere without fungi, but the most interesting ones are wherever you have trees. So if you just pull up Google Maps satellite view and look for the nearest green spot to you on the map, that's a good place to look for mushrooms. I usually look for places that have bigger trees, because when they cut down the trees, a lot of the more interesting fungi die. So the larger and older the trees are, the more likely you are to find interesting fungi. So usually when I'm picking a spot, I look for the greenest part in the map, because that's the part that has the most water, which has the largest trees, and then go there. And if it's been raining, or even if it hasn't, there's always fungi to find.
I've seen a lot of very interesting places where fungi is found. I mean, I've even seen that fungi can be found in the gas tanks of airliners, which is Boeing 747s. I did see that fungi have still yet to be found in deep sediments on seafloor and surfaces of deserts and in the frozen valleys of Antarctica, but that literally leaves out pretty much everywhere else in the world, which is, I don't know, maybe 67% of like what we can inhabit, like on land.
And there are pretty good mushrooms in the desert. As soon as it rains in the desert, all the mycelium wakes up and fruits.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, for how much spore is actually in the air, that makes a lot of sense. It could be pretty much anywhere. Well, thanks, Alan.
They're very tenacious. As an example, I think NASA sent out a bunch of lichens out of space for like 6 months,
yeah,
and then pulled them back into the International Space Station. And I think within 15 minutes, they started functioning, mm-hmm, like nothing happened. So even if conditions are really tough for quite a long time, fungi will spring back. And they're kind of, I see them as the safety net of this whole intricate web of life. We've had several mass extinction. I believe it was five. Are we causing the sixth one?
Yes, Anthropocene.
That is happening right now. And fungi will always be there to bring back life as we know it, not right now, as long as the conditions are right for long enough. But it doesn't mean we should take for granted what we have right now and accept that this is all going to go away. We can still do so much to keep this in the amazing prime condition.
That's why conservation is so important. I think it's time to maybe talk about some of the functions of fungi. We could probably do a whole podcast on this because, as we said, fungi can be microscopic yeast, which are important for, you know, your beer, bread, pizza, whatever. And then, you know, you have the 10 square kilometer wood and rock devourers. So Jasper, let's address the biological functions of fungi and then maybe address some of their functions that relate to humans so our audience can kind of relate. And Alan, please feel free to chime in as well. And same with Maria.
Okay. So with fungi, like there's different classifications. You have the saprophytes, which are the recyclers of the whole world. So they eat all of the things that die in the end. So a good example of the importance of these saprophytes, these recyclers, is that when trees evolved, lignin, which is what like it makes them go really tall and really strong, for a long time, nothing could break down this lignin. And this is why we have a lot of coal in the ground, because these trees would die and stack up into each other. At one point, fungi figured out how to break down lignin. And it's really essential because before humans came and started like using it as furniture and fire, like every tree that was around and died would just stack up. And this is like a big part of, sorry, I just got distracted by somebody coming and checking my breathe for some reason. So I need to get back into my train of thought. That's what you have when you live in an office. So that's like, you have to sacrifice, they break down. Like even if we die, fungi will be a big part in breaking us down. Then you have the parasites. There's also fungi that parasitize other organisms. Cordyceps are like one of the most famous examples. Chaga is a fungus that parasitizes the birch tree and creates this kind of like a cancerous swell that eventually will kill the tree. And I think even the honey mushroom of the Armillaria genus is one of those parasites, but they are kind of like very fluid in what they can do. Like often parasites can then act as a saprophyte to like break down the thing that it just helped to kill. But then there's also the mycorrhizal that fuse these beautiful symbiotic connections to the roots of trees. And then you have different classifications within the mycorrhizal, which are, you have the endo and the ecto mycorrhizal. So you have the endo means within, and they penetrate the roots of the tree. But then you have the ecto mycorrhizal, and they're apparently more complex because they weave in between the cell walls without penetrating them and form this net, which is called the Hartig net, which helps protect the roots of the tree from pathogens and other things. So it kind of creates this shield for the tree. But then you have also have endophytic fungi, and then you have yeasts, which are saprophytes, which I love yeasts because they used to be multicellular organisms that evolved into single cellular organisms. And that's what I've been taught. But like in a nutshell, I read a quote somewhere and I do not remember where I read it. So, but like, please don't attribute this to me. But I read somewhere and clicked, they're the masters of death, creators of life. And that's kind of their role in our ecosystem, kind of this harboring of the beautiful balance of life and death.
Wow, that's beautiful. They play a crucial role. And you actually brought this up, is that they adapted to consuming lignin. I mean, they learn so quickly and adapt to what they have around them and create food for themselves. I mean, they have fantastic metabolisms. They can break down through tough substances such as like lignin, rock, crude oil, polyurethane plastics, even TNT has been said. The nuclear meltdown site of Chernobyl houses fungi that feed on the waste as well. And not only that, some types of fungi have been noted to grow towards radiation and use radiation as a source of energy, just as plants do with photosynthesis. It's the same process, just a little different substance. And that's fascinating within itself. I think that poses a lot of really interesting things in terms of space travel, maybe someday, speaking as a physicist.
I've definitely heard word of particular studies that are being done with the radiation aspect of mycology and how like certain mushrooms are able to absorb it, or, you know, they're able to utilize radiation, and they're starting to hypothesize using it in cancer patients, where when they're getting radioactive treatment done, that whenever they're taking mushroom supplements, that it's able to actually absorb it so that their body's not taking as big of a toll. So that's actually, if it's a hypothesis that's being used right now, a little bit of study is being touched on, which I'm really excited, but there's not a lot of official documentation of that out there. But I heard of it and was like, oh my God, that would be so cool, you know.
You know, a lot of people hear that mushrooms can eat radiation, and I think maybe it's the answer to radioactive spills. But, you know, people say a lot of stuff about mushrooms is just not true. So they can metabolize radiation, but that doesn't mean they're like useful to clean up something like Chernobyl. Or people say that they eat plastic, which is technically true, but it's not actually true in any practical sense of the word. Same with like trying to clean up oil spills. You know, there's a reason we don't use mushrooms to clean up the oil spills, because it barely works. So I think people also a lot of times over-exaggerate what fungi can do.
So now, do you think that at one point we can create something that is more functional? Because like we, for example, are working with Bacillotopsis microsporae. It's very slow at eating polyurethane. But do you think that in the future we can like kind of propagate this culture that will be faster? Or do you think it's all just headliner hype for clicks and that we have to...
The Pestovadiopsis microspora, I've been growing it for a lot of years. And one thing about it is that it does eat polyurethane, but not chunks of polyurethane like we think of chunks of plastic. It only eats aqueous polyurethane, which is not particularly useful because aqueous polyurethane is a very tiny percentage of the polyurethane that we have. And then also it eats other carbon sources before it eats the polyurethane. So if you try to like put it in the landfill, not only is the plastic in the landfill not an aqueous solution, but even if it could eat regular chunks of plastic, it would eat all those other carbon sources first. So it would actually not really do anything to the plastic in the landfill.
That makes sense. It's more of a foreign material. So they're not going to try to learn a new process. They don't have to.
It's difficult to break those hydrocarbon bonds.
Yeah, definitely. That's why it's such an issue. Be really nice, but the radiation thing is actually being conducted at Einstein University. So if you were interested in doing more of a read up on that, look up their research. Just to move on, I guess we can even talk about penicillin. Penicillin was discovered in 1928, and it led the way of the antibiotic revolution. Found that fungi distracts enzymes in bacteria that then produce cell walls, which leads to their deaths. Thank fungi for extending human lifespans by nearly 30 years in places like the US. And actually, with penicillin, one of the whole reasons why the Allies won World War II is because US and England had it, and Japan and Germany did not.
Little fun anecdotes on the discovery. When Alexander Fleming, I think he was working in London, he went on holiday and he left his bacterial samples and petri dishes on his desk. And he came back and we're all eaten by this mold. And he's like, that's how it connected. I love how science and discoveries often are little coincidences or little mistakes. Maybe it's a story that somebody made up and like went through, but like, I like it when it's kind of an accident.
Oh yeah, definitely. And you were talking about how fungi can be pathogenic maniacs. They can destroy entire harvests of important crops like rice and corn, bananas, you name it. They also, like humans, cause mass extinctions. The Australian National University has found that a fungal disease has caused dramatic population declines in at least 501 amphibian species, including 90 extinctions over the past 50 years. So it's not something to be taken lightly either. Well, all right. Mycelium has come up already in the show multiple times, and I think now it would be a good time to maybe talk about what mycelium is. And Alan, would you mind enlightening the viewers?
Mycelium is the vegetative part of the fungus. So all mushrooms have mycelium that's in the substrate. Most of the organism is this mycelium. And then when the mycelium is done digesting its substrate and it's going to die off, then it says, okay, it's time to move. And then it fruits and makes the mushroom or fungus that you actually see.
Thank you very much. One thing that intrigues me about mycelium is that it can hold up to 30,000 times its mass, which in my realm for engineering purposes is you think of erosion and erosion prevention. Next to plant life, plant matter, it's second to none in terms of erosion prevention.
It's incredibly strong. In fact, Phil Ross does a lot of this mycelium building material stuff. And he had a display at the San Francisco Fungus Fair a few years ago. And he had all these blocks of mycelium. They were pretty thin blocks, pretty lightweight. And so I decided I would just go walk up to the table and see if I could break one of these blocks. And if I could break it, you know, it would make him look kind of silly, but I just wanted to see how strong this stuff was. So I picked up a rather thin tile and just with all my strength, tried as hard as I could to break it, and it did not budge. So it was very impressive, and his product definitely passed the test.
Yeah. So because mycelium is like a web-based kind of construct, it works really well in bending. Sorry, as the engineer. Yeah, I was going to actually bring that up at some point. It's as a building fanatic, the application is mostly architectural. Mycelium can be used as sustainable decor. It can be used as insulation. There's companies that are trying to make that work, which is fantastic. And then also furniture. I'm sure you're well aware. I mean, there's plenty of sources out there of that. I'm curious to see how that shakes up in the future, because as we move to a more sustainable approach to buildings and to the way that we want to microclimate our inhabitable space, mycelium definitely could be the answer. I don't see why not. As long as people can get over the fact that they have mycelium all around them, I think it's beautiful. I mean, it's kind of a niche thing, but I think it would really work in terms of having a substitute from what we're using in terms of insulation, like fiberglass and plastic. Both are not great for our lungs due to the particulate matter above and below the 2.5 micron size. It gets in your lungs and it tears it up. So if we can do that, that would be fantastic.
And if it is going to be practical, we got to see how well it compares with all the other building materials. Like, you know, I think maybe recycled plastic is also pretty promising, because if these mycelium materials get wet, they're going to get moldy. So that's one issue that we got to think about. And then it takes a lot of energy to sterilize the substrate to grow the mycelium. But it might turn out that it is the best material for some applications.
I think it's promising as insulation.
Yeah, that's why I said architectural. The structural component, if you could make it work and make it strong enough in terms of the application, I don't see why not. Yeah, you would have to do a life cycle analysis and see what the embodied energy is for mycelium bricks. But I think that would be really interesting.
There's so much that we have to discover, and a lot has just been used with these really straightforward myceliums. Like most of the myco building that's been happening is with reishi, Ganoderma. But I think there might be a mushroom or a fungus that we've not so used to consuming in its fruiting body form that might be more applicable to these systems. And that's why we need more people experimenting and doing all the things, because right now we're looking mostly at the big 10 on medicinal purposes and like just overall usability purposes. But I'm sure there's going to be some massive breakthroughs where nobody's looking just yet.
Right. And you're really interested in the applications of mycelium. Paul Stamets, that guy knows a lot about mycelium. Look up his application and a lot of his research. But just to give a scale, figured that would kind of help people at home listening or watching. In a single cubic inch of soil, there can be more than 8 miles of mycelium cells. That's kind of crazy. In every tree root that is 3 foot, you get a whole kilometer of mycelium. So you think about it, that's 2,200 feet compared to 3 foot of tree root. That's why fungi make up 30% of the biomass that we have in our soil, at least.
We're a little over time, but when we come back from commercial break, we'll be continuing to talk about everything on mycology and more. So stay tuned. Like what you hear? Do us a favor at Woke Talk Podcast by giving us a follow, review, and sharing our content on social media. Woke Talk Podcast is conveniently on Twitter, Instagram, Reddit, and Facebook. You can stream our animated audio content through our YouTube channel, or you can listen to our episodes that will feature each Thursday on Anchor, Spotify, Podbean, Amazon Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Breaker. If you, the listener, have any content suggestions or want to be a guest star on the show, reach out to Woke Talk Podcast via email at woketalkpodcast@gmail.com. And we are back. I want to start off by talking about what the Wood Wide Web is.
The mycorrhizae trees and also 90% of plants. I think you brought it up earlier that like most, if not all plants are linked to the Wood Wide Web. But without the mycorrhizae, many plants would perish because plants cannot sequester nitrogen. And mycorrhizae pulls nitrogen from the atmosphere and transport it via the Wood Wide Web to its plants in exchange for energy. So very interesting concept.
I can add a little bit to that because I think the 90% is a very moderate estimate because the most
conservative.
Yeah. Most mycologists that I've been talking to, like they claim to be 100%. Personally, I'm more of an educator and trying to put these things to the masses in the best way I can. But like this is the giving that I've been giving from the mushrooms, mainly psychedelic mushrooms, that they're just everywhere. And the Wood Wide Web, I think the term can sometimes be derogatory because people assume they're just like a cable network, but there's so much more. They're more like orchestrators of the whole forest ecosystem. And anybody that's interested should read the Finding the Mother Tree by Suzanne Simmert. Suzanne Simmert has been doing so much research in the field and been doing this for a long time. And she was the person that found the carbon-12 isotope that was transferred from one tree to the other because like she blocked it off from being able to photosynthesize and in the middle of the Canadian forest. So there's a lot of cool research that kind of hyped up this term, but she goes quite in depth in her research and her experience in finding the mother tree.
I'm honestly gonna have to put this show on repeat a few times just to reteach myself this stuff. But so now that we talked about mycelium, let's kind of shift and talk about how fungi spread or reproduce. So Alan,
please transfer some knowledge about fungi reproduction and spores.
Well, they got a lot of different strategies, but the most obvious one is spores. So spores are these kind of hardened capsules that have half of the genome of the mushroom. And so when two spores of the same species germinate near each other, well, when a spore germinates, they make haploid mycelium, at least if it's a basidiospore. And the haploid mycelium has half the genome and it meets another germinated spore. So it's another monokaryotic mycelium. And these two fuse to make dikaryotic mycelium. And then they have the whole genome and they can fruit mushrooms. So that's like the regular mushroom sexual spores. The fungi also make a lot of asexual spores. And those have the whole genome. So they're basically cloning themselves. So they don't get genetic diversity, but they are able to make a fully functional copy with just one spore. And then a lot of fungi can clone themselves just by having little bits of the mycelium. They can fly around or, you know, get stuck to an animal or something. And so that's another way that they clone themselves.
Can you maybe elaborate a little bit more on mating types?
Yeah, so humans have two mating types. We have male and female. So that means if we meet someone, the chance that we're sexually compatible with them is 50%. Fungi usually have a lot more mating types. So that means that like some fungi have thousands of mating types. So if they meet another of the same species, the chance that they're sexually compatible is extremely high because they have thousands of sexes.
I like those odds. Should have been a fungi. Yeah. There are also many species of fungi that can take over another organism's body. Like for example, the carpenter ant. So the mycelium will grow within them and it takes over their bodies. Some can manipulate and move the ant and some just live and die in their place. But the end goal, like I said, is to spread the spores. So mushrooms will grow out of the ant carcass and sporulation will commence. So Paul Stamets actually has a patent of mycelium invasive species defense that covers roughly 200,000 species. I don't know why we're still using RAID and poisoning each other. It just blows my mind.
I do like Ophiocordyceps unilateralis, which I think is the species of fungus that attacks mainly carpenter ants. And I like the story around it as well. Like this is why I went quite deep into it is because this is like one of the most, you have zombie ants, mushrooms, right? That's what everybody wants to hear. So what I find really cool is like we still don't really know how they influence the movement of the ant. At first, people thought that they might tap into the nervous system. Now it seems to be something more biochemical, but like it knows when to retain its growth. So the ant can still move, right? Because the movement of the ant has to do with a compression of some things. Like I think insects move by pressure in these tubes and like releasing tension and giving tension. So like the fungus has to understand how this body functions so it can move it up the tree, because that's what I think they do. That's the carpenter ant, the Ophiocordyceps unilateralis. It moves its victim up the tree and then it does this dead clamp. And it does it because these carpenter ants live in the trees, but they have to move between the trees to get the right food at times. And then it wants to get high and then release the spores down on the colony below. But that the fungus is aware of all these quite intricate patterns. And to me, it's like quite weird. Like, I don't even know what it would be like to be a fungus, but for a fungus to be in a living being and then understand how the body moves and forces that organism to move is just absolutely mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, it really is. So, I mean, how many spores are there in and around us? I know we talked about how they can...
I believe it's a metric fuckton.
Fair enough. It was actually funny. I was listening to Star Talk and Merlin Sheldrake was on talking to Neil deGrasse Tyson. And they asked the question, they're like, so Merlin, how many spores are in and around us? And he's like, a lot. I mean, he then gave a number, but I mean, he was just like, yeah, it's a lot. I mean,
any number you give is going to be wrong.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. He gave out a really cool statistic. I mean, if anybody wants to hear it, I quoted it. So, I mean, this is Merlin. And he said each year there's an estimated 50 million tons of fungal spores that are released into the air, which equates to 500,000 blue whales. I like numbers, so I think that's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say whenever you take a breath of air, you're breathing in fungal spores.
Yeah. We're also participating in the process of panspermia. I mean, if we were all sitting together in a room, you're giving me your spores, I'm giving you my spores, we're exchanging, you know, we're exchanging these substances that create a different life. It's a really interesting concept.
Yeah, let's get into spores though, because a visualization that always stuck with me is from Mushrooms Demystified by David Aurora. And he talks about the giant puffball mushroom, I think genus Claviceps, but he visualized it very beautifully that one giant puffball mushroom contains enough spores that if you put every single spore next to each other, it can rotate the earth. But then if every one of those spores would turn into another giant puffball mushrooms, it would create a line that goes to the sun and back. That's how many spores can be in one mushroom. So a lot.
Whoa, that's crazy. Also, spores are really tough. They can survive the vacuum space. Like you said earlier, what was it, lichen? You said they were putting it in the International Space Station. Actually, that's called their exposed facility. So that's where they do a lot of that stuff. And then they have a Mars facility here in, I can't remember where it was at. I think it's in Arizona, but they put them in those test chambers and simulate Mars. And spores have stood the test of time in the Mars facility.
What do you guys think about these mushrooms that they claim to have found on Mars?
I don't know about it.
Yeah? Okay, sweet.
I don't think so.
I just like it's the headline. But you think it's complete bullshit?
Well, definitely, because there's nothing on Mars that they could be living on. And the guy who made the discovery has a long history of lying about Mars.
Yes, that is right.
Yeah, that's basically his profession.
Oh, lying about Mars. That's a good thing to have on your resume.
So he just gets gullible reporters to take his line of bullshit and put it on the front page. And then he's like, haha.
Yeah, compelling photos though, but I was definitely dubious. Like it seemed interesting. But then the whole idea of panspermia came into the debate, right? Like, oh no, did our spaceships carry these like spores that could be puffballs to Mars? And do you think that this could be an option? But there's nothing for them to grow on, you're saying, Alan.
So what we should do is pack a rocket with dried mushrooms and explosives, and then launch it. And once it's past Pluto, then we can detonate the explosives and that will spawn life on millions of planets.
Okay. So anybody that has a lot of money, let's make it happen.
Yeah, it's illegal. So it'd have to be an underground project because it would violate quite a few space treaties.
Yes.
Jeff Bezos has enough money and enough power, he can do it. So just convince him. I feel like you two can definitely do that. I don't think spores can really do anything on Mars. Go listen to our Mars podcast. I don't think that,
definitely not.
What's going on Mars? It cannot facilitate life. It really can't. What you could find is possibly fossils or some sort of record of life previously, but I mean, no real Mars or no like NASA representative is going to sit here and be, oh yeah, we're definitely finding life on Mars. And panspermia is just skepticism filled at this point right now, but it's a cool concept. It really is.
But what about like the early solar system? And they say, right, just like quoting other people's research, but like that Mars and Venus were probably more like hospitable to life than Earth was. And maybe it originated there and then it launched to us. How plausible do you see this? I love the clear skepticism because I am that deep inside, but I try my hardest to be an optimist.
See, I study astronomy and I'm into physics. Actually, Mars did form around the same time that the Earth did, about 4.6 billion years ago. And it said that Mars lost its ability to harbor life a lot sooner than what Earth was then able to facilitate and harbor life. So yes, there is. That's why I was saying that there's a great possibility that we find through the cores that we're doing on Mars, we're not going to be able to find these cores or analyze them until 2035 when we actually get rovers there to pick them up. But there is a great chance in which we could find past life from whenever Mars was habitable. So yes, I mean, Mars is in the habitable zone of the solar system. It's a great working hypothesis, not a theory because we haven't observed it yet. It's a great hypothesis and it's very, very likely. Well, perfect. I know we touched on mushrooms being the reproductive mechanisms of fungi that spread spores. So let's kind of switch gears to mushrooms. I would love it if Alan could address the types of mushrooms that we encounter in the wild. And I think it is a pretty important segue because one, it'll lead us into the next segment, but also possibly address the phenomena of mycophobia, the fear of mushrooms. People, I think, are scared of mushrooms because there are like slim yet identifiable differences between ones that can be good for you and then ones that can possibly harm you. So Alan, you got the floor, man.
Well, there's hundreds of thousands of species of mushrooms. Many of them are not named, and all of these mushrooms create tons of really interesting chemicals, and they're not random chemicals. They're a lot of chemicals that have biological uses. So some of these mushrooms, you eat them and then you die. Others are psychedelic or edible. So there's just all sorts of different forms and ecological strategies. And I think the most interesting part of mycology is taxonomy, which is the naming of organisms. So I spend a lot of time in the woods photographing interesting mushrooms, and then I bring them back home and try to figure out what they are. And that's really rewarding because it gives me a really good reason to go out into the woods and get to see and photograph all this sort of diversity. But there's really no limit to the chemicals that mushrooms have. A lot of the chemicals that are in mushrooms, people don't even have names for yet. And so some of them will turn out to be medicines. Some of them will turn out to be carcinogens. You know, there's mushrooms that glow in the dark and do all sorts of cool stuff.
Yeah, if anybody's interested, I also gave everyone a shout out. So definitely go and look at your Instagram, also your Twitter page, just to check out what you've been finding and what you've been doing in terms of mushroom taxonomy. Really cool stuff. Also, Fungi Academy. Jasper, you said that there was something going on with your socials. So, I mean,
yeah, we're being targeted by totalitarianism and censorship, as always, for spreading the magical fungal wisdom. Unfortunately, that's books for Instagram and Facebook. But I cannot recommend following Alan enough because he's like, I think even one of the best mushroom photographers on this planet. And love seeing his photos. So yeah, I think foraging is the best way to connect to the fungal queendom for anybody that wants to go in. It's a great excuse to go out. You tap into this ancient part of us that is in the forest looking for things we can eat and like like, even if you're not interested in eating any of it, that's the thing that you're tapping into. And then you get to learn your land. Like, this amazing YouTube channel by Adam Herrington is named. I think that name is so good. Like, go out and see what other organisms you are sharing your land with. And there's nothing more rewarding than finding a new species, creating a bucket list of species that you want to find. I found an old man of the forest for the first time the other day. I was so stoked because I've been looking for that guy forever. And then it's suddenly there and you're like, oh, it's here. And yeah, I don't know. Maybe, I don't know if you guys have Easter eggs hunts, but like, that's how I felt as a kid. And that I feel like a kid again. I feel like I'm exploring and I'm learning and I'm enjoying and all the beautiful things of life. So going out and finding mushrooms, one of the best things.
And hopefully you saved that mushroom that you found, because Strobilomyces has not been studied very much and you probably discovered a new species.
Oops, I ate it.
Ooh.
Oh, no. Okay. Next time for you, Alan, I'll clone every mushroom I found. Okay.
Yeah, like just the interesting ones. Definitely get good pictures and then pick them. So the next thing is to dry them and save them.
Okay.
And record the data around them, like what kind of trees were around, the flavor, what it looks like when you cut it in half, that sort of thing. And then with microscopy and DNA sequencing, we can start to figure out these species.
Yes. Okay. Thank you for reminding me. I will do that from now on, saving them, drying them. If you have enough, you can eat one.
Yeah. Yeah. I save everything I photograph. Because if I don't, I know someone's going to ask for it, or I'm going to wonder, what is this a picture of? And without a dried specimen, I really have no way of knowing.
So real quick, Alan, do you want to like kind of run people through like your sequence in terms of what you do after you find a mushroom in the wild?
If I just see one mushroom, I'll usually keep walking. I'll usually look for a big collection of mushrooms, so several different stages of maturity. If I see one thing that's really rare and cool, like I saved one Gymnopolis punctifolius yesterday, because that one's something I've been looking for a while. But usually I'll look for a whole bunch of different mushrooms at different stages of development. And, you know, they're kind of scattered around. So I will move them all into the same frame so I can get a nice picture that shows with one photo, the top, the gills, a young one, an old one, just so you can have one picture that kind of shows all the different forms the organism can have. And then if it's something small, I'll put it in a tackle box. If it's bigger, I'll put it in Tupperware. Either way, it keeps it from getting crushed on my backpack, keeps the samples separate. And then when I get back to my car, I put them all on the dashboard. And if they're little tiny mushrooms, I'll put them in a paper bag. So they dry on my dashboard in a paper bag, which I write the collection numbers and date and location on. So I always know which dried mushroom goes with which photo. If they're bigger mushrooms, I just toss them up in the dashboard, drive around for a couple of days until they're cracker dry. And then I'll put them into a Ziploc, and if it's a humid environment, with desiccant. And when I get back home, or sometimes even before I get back home, I do microscopy and PCR on them. So the microscopy, I look at the shape and size of the spores and the pileopellus, the lamellar cystidia, all the other features that are unique to the different species. And then with the PCR, I have a PCR machine that runs in my car, or I'll just dry it and bring it back to the lab. But when I run the PCR, sometimes I'll just like, you know, when I'm driving from one place to another, you know, the PCR machine takes a couple hours. So instead of idling the car for a couple hours, I'll just power it up when I'm driving and then do some gel electrophoresis to see if the PCR worked and drop it off at the nearest FedEx. And by the time I get home from my vacation, I have DNA sequences of all the stuff I've been finding. So the DNA sequences are really cool because that's what helps unlock all of the different taxa that I see. The DNA sequencing tells me what the mushroom is and where else in the world it's been found. And then a lot of times I'll blast the sequence and there'll be nothing that shows up, which means it's something that no one else has sequenced before. And in that case, the microscopy is critical for figuring out if it has a name yet.
Oh, wow. So that's important. One thing to note, I mean, if anybody's out there looking for mushrooms and you come across something extremely extravagant, send it to people like Alan, because he knows what he's doing and he could definitely help you out there.
I get a lot of mushrooms in the mail. A lot of times I'll see something, someone posts something super rare on Facebook that I think doesn't have a name yet, or maybe it does have a name, but is something that is really interesting and understudied. I'll just ask for them to send me a little bit. And when it gets here, I do DNA sequencing. And if the sequence indicates that it's something really interesting, then I'll spend the time on the microscopy. But But yeah, a lot of stuff comes in the mail from all over the place. And it's really cool. Just like, you know, some amateur out there, like doesn't really know a lot about mushrooms, comes across something really rare, and to be able to, you know, get a DNA sequence into GenBank from all these finds, does a lot of good for when people later on, like try to name this or try to study the species. All these sequences I'm putting into GenBank will come up when they do their searches.
Yeah. And if anybody is interested in learning more about this, I've hosted Alan's talk on DNA sequencing at home for beginners. It's for free on YouTube. So if you want to go deep, just look at DNA sequencing, Alan Rockefeller, and then you'll find it on YouTube.
Perfect. And I think you talked about this, Jasper. I mean, it's super rewarding. I mean, it's something like it's the Easter egg hunt. It's really awesome whenever you get to get out in the woods and then find something new. It's discovery. I mean, there's not a lot. I mean, there's a lot in life that we still haven't discovered and don't understand, but that's, I mean, mushrooms is one of them. And it's something that anybody can really do. I mean, the vast majority of people can do. So get out there and do it. It's really fun.
And like save them, because I might have just eaten a new species of Stromboliomyces by accident.
I think that is a fantastic place to stop, because when we come back from this commercial break, I'm going to hand it over to Maria, where she will be showcasing her research on psilocybin and its application for hypnotherapy. So stay tuned.
Woke Talk Podcast would like to acknowledge Tree Cup Tea for their delicious organic tea and their cause for reforesting the island of Haiti. At the start of 2006, Haiti was stripped of 80% of their forest due to agricultural malpractice. Because of their partnership with Haiti Friends, a nonprofit tree planting organization, Tree Cup Tea's goal is to fully restore Haiti's forest by 2030 and continue to support reforestation worldwide. Tree Cup Tea sells 4 different flavors of tea that can be bought by the 12-pack and delivered right to your door. With every purchase, 12 trees will be planted in Haiti, along with a supply of 12 complimentary maple tree seeds that can be planted in your very own neighborhood. To learn more about their cause, operations, and tea, go to www.treecuptea.com or follow Woke Talk Podcast on social media platforms such as Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter to find Tree Cup Tea's official link. Just remember, Tree Cup Tea uses your contributions of buying their tea to plant a beautiful tree.
Hey, everybody. We are back here on Woke Talk Podcast for the final segment of Mycology is Beautiful Biology. This segment is going to feature Maria's research on neurobiology, psilocybin, and its use for effective hypnotherapy.
Psilocybin is a naturally psychedelic compound produced in the genus Psilocybe, and it contains more than 200 species of mushrooms. In general, psilocybin-containing species are dark spored. They're gilled mushrooms that grow in meadows and woods and subtropics and tropics, usually found in areas with soils that are rich in humus, which is plant debris. Psilocybin mushrooms occur in all continents, but the majority of the species are found in the subtropical humid forest. In Europe, North America, Asia, South America, Australia, and New Zealand are all places that these have been found and are successfully farmed. The one major place that it's not usually found and farmed successfully in is in Mexico. These drugs are ingested. Psilocybin is quickly converted to the body by the body into psilocin, which is the active compound of the drug. This production is taken place in the liver through a process called desulfurylation. Whenever this drug is ingested, that includes euphoria, visuals, mental hallucination, changes in perception, a distorted sense of time, spiritual experiences. Of course, too much of a good thing can be a bad thing, and any adverse reactions could be things such as nausea or anything taken in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong people could cause panic attacks. So, of course, do not do your own studies at home with this, and this should be clinically administered. In terms of structure in organic structure, psilocin is a tryptamine alkaloid, which means it's a structural analog of the neurotransmitter serotonin. And what I mean by that is that it's pretty much picture perfect with the organic chemistry of serotonin. For all of you organic chemistry nerds, psilocin and serotonin differ because the psilocin has 2 methyl groups on the amine group on carbon 3, and the substituent groups on the benzyl ring are in position 4 rather than on position 5. So that may not make any sense to you. It barely makes sense to me, simply because organic chemistry is not easy to understand. So a little bit of background on the area of the brain that's affected by this compound is... The area of the brain is called serotonin signaling pathway. It's the pattern of the brain that regulates, produces, and signals the neurotransmitter serotonin. Serotonin is the key hormone that stabilizes our mood, feelings, and feelings of well-being and happiness. It impacts the entire body, and it enables the brain cells and other nervous system cells to communicate with one another. Neurons are the synthesizing sites of the neurotransmitter serotonin. So they're pretty much the producers of this neurotransmitter. And they originate in the raphe nuclei, which is a very small localized area in the brainstem. Once it's produced, these serotonergic fibers innervate all corners of the brain. The umbrella term for this production and spread of serotonin is the serotonergic signaling pathway. And as a whole, the system works in order to balance the emotions via inhibitory and excitatory signaling. So inhibitory is like the red light and excitatory is the green light for your brain to release different neurotransmitters throughout the brain, especially serotonin in this system of the brain. So typically, if there's any dysfunction in this system and there's a dysfunction in the inhibitory or excitatory areas of the brain, let's say you have a hard time inhibiting dopamine, you're going to be hyped up on dopamine all the time. It can cause an imbalance in emotion. Typically, dysfunction in this area of the brain is correlated with people who struggle with depressive disorder or lack of concentration. So in the functionality of this pathway, after the production, serotonin, like I said, is a neurotransmitter. And a neurotransmitter is like a car and the receptor is like a parking spot. So in this entire system, there's 14 serotonin receptors that all regulate different activities. And the parking spot that we're talking about today for serotonin is the 5-HT2A parking space. And this is where psilocin actually can park itself in place of serotonin, because they're so similar in structure that it's actually able to mimic the effects of what serotonin does in this particular receptor. And this particular receptor has been shown in studies of all different psychedelic compounds like LSD, ketamine, or whatever other studies have been going on in terms of this. The 5-HT2A is typically the receptor that's affected. When they're ingested, they mimic the effects of serotonin. And whenever they're doing this, they have an agonist property, meaning that it initiates the serotonergic signaling pathway. So it practically puts it on full throttle and it is completely triggering the excitatory synapses of the neurotransmitters, which causes the psychedelic experience. So it's just a very heavy flow of neurotransmitters. So increasing this activity at high levels plays a role in perception additionally, which is what gives the hallucinogenic properties such as hearing colors and feeling sounds and like having that spiritual experience that is explained in many people that undergo psychedelic evaluations when on this drug. So the effects of taking psilocybin work in collaboration in order to alter the normal functioning of the centers related to cognition, perception, and mood overall. For research show that there's an increased functional connectivity across the brain. So the way that I understand this is as if you had a two-lane street and you have one way that a car can travel on the right side of the road or the left, whatever country you're in, and you have one way that you're able to go. And then whenever you take psilocybin, your neurons are these cars and it's actually able to get up off the road and travel in any direction in any dimension that it wants. So the functionality of your brain's connectivity centers is functioning at a much, much higher rate so that parts of your brain can communicate with parts that have never been able to communicate before or are only able to communicate when you're like really trying to do that. So it actually causes neuroplasticity, which allows your brain to be more flexible in the way that it's thinking. There was a study done at Yale showing that these compounds actually also increase the density of dendritic spines, which are practically the branches of your neurons, which can help with neuroplasticity and the regeneration of neurons in your brain, which is really interesting. So having these effects, it allows for new insights on old problems, and it has the potential for psilocybin to be able to treat anxiety, depression, addiction, and plenty other mental health issues. And it also has the ability to repair the neurons in the brain. So another really, really cool function of the brain. So it affects serotonin, but serotonin affects a bunch of different areas of the brain. Serotonin is like one single grain of rice that has plenty of power. So there's three major parts of the brain that are affected when taking psilocybin. So there's the amygdala, prefrontal cortex, and the posterior cingulate gyrus. The amygdala is the area of the brain where you have a fear. So that you can either have a reduced amygdala response or an advanced one. And most of the time we have it just at like this regular basis. But when you take psilocybin, it actually reduces the amygdala response. So you don't have very much fear when addressing things. So this can actually be very, very beneficial. And studies have shown for cancer patients that have to address the fear of death, they're actually much more willing to understand and to start to confront these very, very fearful concepts that they weren't able to do beforehand and without the drug. So that's one of the reasons that it could be super long-term, is because it allows people to come to these huge epiphanies of understanding things that they were too afraid to address beforehand. Additionally, with the amygdala, there's the prefrontal cortex and the posterior cingulate gyrus, which work together that's what they call your ego area. So whenever those are actually deactivated, you take psilocybin. So that leads to reduced self-awareness, which leads to ego transcendence, which it can also be found in studies with meditation and introspective therapies. So with a reduced self-awareness and a reduced ego, patients have shown that there's very little judgment of self, which means that they get a lot more confidence and there's less hesitation to address topics that once humiliated them or something that they were ashamed to admit before, which is another very, very beneficial long-term effect of like having these epiphanies when undergoing the therapeutic administration of psilocybin. So outside of those two areas of the brain, another grain of rice that is affected is dopamine. Dopamine, it's indirectly increases the concentration of dopamine, which is always a good thing. It's associated with reward and it increases your motivation, your happiness, your awareness and focus. When psilocybin is taken in microdoses, it also has the effects without the hallucinogenic visual and auditory responses that it normally has. So there's a lot of debate on like the proper dosage. And of course, this goes along with any antidepressant drug, but there is definitely a range and a spectrum of how effective the drug can be depending on what you're trying to address as well. So that leads me into the comparison between typical SSRIs, which are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. They're very similar. So there's a lot of comparison between the two. There's a lot of studies that show more long-term effects, whereas SSRIs typically take a lot longer to affect the brain in the same way that psilocybin is capable of doing under one dosage. So the effect that psilocybin has on perception is what gives it the ability to be a little bit more effective than traditional selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, such as Prozac and Zoloft. Two independent studies by Griffiths and Ross, done in 2016, demonstrated that psilocybin can actually produce a rapid clinical significant decrease in the symptoms of depression and anxiety and can persist for up to 6 months under just two administrations. The antidepressant effects of SSRIs and other conventional antidepressants, however, require at least 3 to 6 weeks to achieve clinical efficacy. And with a single dose of psychedelic mushrooms, the alterations of perception, reduced fear, and spiritual experiences could collectively overthrow the effects of conventional antidepressants, which I found very, very impactful. As for therapeutic administration, how this typically goes is there's usually somebody that clinically supervises you while undergoing psychedelic administration in terms of the therapeutic administration of psilocybin. Typically, this treatment, it's very important to be supervised by a clinical professional while undergoing the therapeutic administration. So a lot of the times they give you like a blanket, proper hydration, music, and most importantly, they give you an intention that you are willing to address during this time, much like you would in typical therapeutic sessions. Like you have something you would like to deal with and you take the drug and you're able to walk through it. And this professional is actually able to communicate with you and make sure that you are safe, comfortable, and you're in a good environment in order to really benefit from the experience. So it's important to have that intention to ensure the focus and success and the active healing of the brain for the mental health of the patient. So I'm not saying let's all go out into the woods and eat what we can find and have a crazy experience, but it is believed that this psychedelic experience could be a key mediator of long-term changes in mental health. So,
wow. First of all, there's so many applications that flowed through my head in that total sequence. I'm thinking of the applications of everything that somebody does for their day job. I feel like it could help and enhance. How far off are we from being able to introduce this into big pharma?
Well, you know, psilocybin is a dangerous drug. It's not as dangerous as alcohol or tobacco, but I have a couple friends that have had pretty serious negative reactions to psilocybin, but you know, most of my friends take psilocybin, so it's a large sample size, but people that drink alcohol generally have more problems, you know, in their life than people who take psilocybin. So it's not completely safe, but it's not super dangerous either. But, you know, I work for a psilocybin company called Mimosa Therapeutics. And so we are trying to make psilocybin more available. And I think the more people that take it, the more benefits it'll have. And so in general, I think it's a good thing. People can experience benefits both in clinical settings and also if they take it on their own. You know, I've never tried it in a clinical setting. I've only taken it on my own, and I've certainly experienced good benefits and never had any problems with it. But, you know, obviously it's safer in a clinical setting. But, you know, I think that depression is extremely common. I don't know what percentage of people experience depression, but I think it's got to be the majority of people experience some depression at some point of their life. It's kind of a normal part of human existence is depression. But it's also a huge waste of time, because if you feel depressed, then you just don't have the motivation to do things. And I know when I feel depressed, I just like don't get anything done, just like not very productive. And when I'm in that kind of mood, I don't feel like taking psilocybin because I don't feel like doing very much of anything. But if I just think like, okay, this is medicine, I'm going to take it for the medicinal effect. I don't care if I don't feel like it, then the next day and the next week and the next month, I do feel much better and I'm so much more productive. And, you know, sometimes I'll go through a streak where I don't really get anything done for weeks and I'll be like, okay, I need to take the psilocybin. I'll take psilocybin and all of a sudden I'll be super productive for months after that. I'll wake up the next morning and, you know, all the stuff I've been putting off, I'll just start doing. And it's extremely beneficial, you know, for me, but it doesn't work for everybody, but I think it does work for more people than the traditional SSRIs. So.
It has a lot of promise. How far off do you think we are in terms of being able to just go to the doctor and having prescribed psilocybin?
I don't think we're too far off. You know, it's Schedule 1 right now, but it's extremely effective for a lot of people. And, you know, people want medicines that work. And so the public, when they realize what psilocybin does, they're starting to demand access to it. So I think it's important to give people access in various different ways. One way is decriminalization, and the other way is legalization. And I think both decriminalization and legalization are needed in every country in the world, and I think that will happen. So the decriminalization is very important, just so we don't keep throwing people in jail for growing mushrooms, for taking mushrooms, for using mushrooms safely, because this is just a terrible use of tax dollars and an injustice on top of that. So that's the criminalization of mushrooms needs to stop. But legalization is also very important because doctors need access to this. So legalization will give doctors access to prescribe it to their patients. And within the next few years, both of those things will happen. Because there really is no good reason to criminalize these mushrooms. You know, the risk-benefit ratio is just way on the side of benefit. And so they definitely will be decriminalized for a lot of reasons. One of the main ones is that there's no good reason to criminalize it. It was criminalized for bad reasons. They basically wanted to get the Vietnam War protesters, but they couldn't because of the First Amendment. So it's not a coincidence that the psychedelic mushrooms were banned right at the height of the Vietnam War protests. And the people that banned the mushrooms knew exactly what they're doing and have admitted as much recently. You know, the doctors definitely deserve access to it. It's really a shame that there is such an effective treatment out there for depression and addiction. And it's really a shame that the doctors don't have access to it. And the doctors are stuck using subpar medications, the SSRIs, you know, and the other antidepressants that just don't work as well for most people. So this will change. When it changes is going to depend on where you are. You know, I'm in Oakland, California right now, and we did the decriminalization about 2 years ago. So right now it's pretty easy to get psilocybin. There's even stores that sell psilocybin and you can just go into the store and buy it. And now there's 9 different cities and counties in the United States that have done the decriminalization. And just another one, I think it was Seattle just a couple of days ago, did the decriminalization. You know, as people see that the benefits are outweighing the risks and, you know, it's not causing more car accidents, it's not causing more freakouts, it's is generally improving people's health, that this is going to keep spreading on the local level, and then it'll get to the state level. And there's already been a few state level initiatives. It'll probably take a few tries to get those passed, but it will pass the state level. And then once a few states have done it, it will pass on the federal level. And the reason it will is just because it is so effective.
Well, thank you, Maria. Thank you, Alan. That was really good. I want to finish out by giving the floor and asking for some remarks. I know Alan and I, we talked a little bit offset. I mean, everybody did, and we talked about the practicality of some things that were brought up. What are your final remarks, Alan?
There's a lot of different ways to use mushrooms, and some of them are practical and effective, and others are impractical with, you know, the current state of knowledge and not too effective. On the practical side, psilocybin, you know, so many people have depression and addiction issues. And, you know, I think addiction is usually caused by depression. So people feel depressed, and so they're going to medicate with alcohol, with cannabis, with whatever they can get their hands on that makes them feel better. And that can work sort of temporarily, but a lot of these drugs are pretty addictive. And so people kind of get into these negative use patterns with alcohol, with cannabis, with opiates, whatever it is that people find, you know, even caffeine, you know, certainly treats depression in the short term, but probably causes it in the long term. So I think, yeah, it's definitely practical to treat a lot of different issues with psilocybin. And then there's a lot of other medicinal mushrooms too. And, you know, medicinal mushrooms is an extremely broad topic. There are so many mushrooms out there. And only a few of them have been tried for medicine, and some of them are clearly more effective than others. One that's probably pretty effective but needs a lot more study is hericium, lion's mane. Turns out it's not just lion's mane, but all the different hericium species have these nerve growth factors, and it's present more in the mycelium than in the fruiting body. But it's possible that the fruiting body is effective as well. But, you know, growing the mycelium on grain or in liquid culture and just taking the mycelium is probably even more effective than the fruiting body in the case of hericium. But I know one guy that fell off of a third floor balcony and landed on his head. And the doctors told him he would never walk again. But he heard the podcast by Paul Stamets and Joe Rogan about, you know, nerve growth factor and psilocybin microdosing with hericium. And he started taking hericium with psilocybin, and he said that he started recovering very quickly when he started doing that. And of course, it's possible he would have recovered anyway, and that was maybe just his time to recover. But he seems to think that it really did a lot. And a lot of other people say that too. So now, not only can he walk, but he got his driver's license back, and he's almost back to normal. And he credits a combination of psilocybin and hericium for that. And then you have other things like Trimedes versicolor, turkey tail. That has been shown to improve the outcome in cancer patients. So when they do large clinical trials, the double-blinded good studies, and they give some of the group Trimedes versicolor water extract, and some of the group doesn't get it, the people that get it live longer. Now, it doesn't just cure cancer. These people are all getting chemotherapy and radiation. And so it's likely that it doesn't really help a lot if you don't have chemotherapy and radiation, but it's hard to know for sure because it's kind of unethical to withhold life-saving treatments. But some people are scared of chemotherapy and radiation, so they'll withhold it from themselves, and that should be studied more, is to see if there's any mushrooms that can help cancer, you know, without chemotherapy. But definitely turkey tail with chemotherapy will improve survival rates. And then you have Ganoderma. You know, Ganoderma has all sorts of chemicals in it, you know, natural chemicals, and some of them are probably good, some of them are probably bad. There's a lot of oxalates, and they it can cause like nosebleeds and kidney issues if you take a lot of it. But at the same time, Ganoderma can also have an antidepressant effect. I've taken Ganoderma that I just found out in the wild, and I do notice I feel pretty good, not like I'm stoned, but I feel just like I think I should feel, just kind of a mild antidepressant effect. So I think that's pretty promising. Though there's a lot of species of Ganoderma, and most of the studies on Ganoderma didn't do DNA sequencing, so they're not really sure which species they were studying. And so the different species are going to have different ratios, different chemicals. And so nobody really knows which species of Ganoderma or even medicinal mushroom in general is best. Nobody knows how much you should take and for which medical conditions you should take it and for how long to take it and what the best extraction method is. So there's really way more unknowns than there are knowns. But from the data that we do see, there's a lot of promise there. It definitely needs more study. I usually tell people that if they get their medicinal mushrooms for free, they should take them, like they find them out in the woods or someone gives them to them. But it's not usually worth spending a lot of money on medicinal mushrooms because of all the unknowns. Though if I did come down with cancer, I would probably spend my own money on medicinal mushrooms because a lot of them don't have really bad side effects and they do show some benefit. So that's promising. With micro-remediation, there's a lot of different ways to do micro-remediation and lots of different strategies. And it turns out that most of those are not particularly effective. Like if you read the clickbait headlines on Facebook, you'll see that mushrooms will eat plastic. But if you actually look more closely into that, it's not all plastics. It's only like polyurethane that's been dissolved in water. And that's like a really tiny percentage of the plastic that's out there. So like, you know, this Pistacillopsis microspora doesn't just eat polyurethane. It only eats it when it's dissolved in water. And it's not easy to dissolve polyurethane in water. So it's not practical to like break down plastic in landfills using mushrooms because it's not in the right form. And even if we did have mushrooms that did break down the plastics that were in the landfills, which we don't, but we probably will in the future, there's many more easy to break down carbon sources in the landfills. So like mushrooms would have to like break down all the food scraps and everything before they start to touch the plastic. So maybe one day we'll be able to compost plastic, but that'll probably never be practical. You can also filter water using mushrooms. So you pass water through a mycelium block and the water that comes out the other side is more clean. However, the block doesn't really last that long. It kind of gets waterlogged and goes anaerobic and it's probably not really practical to filter water that way, but in the lab you can. Another thing you can do with mushrooms is to eat oil. That's mostly Pleurotus species, so we'll eat oil. And so if you take a drop of oil and put it on a colonized petri dish of Pleurotus mycelium, the oil will immediately soak into the mycelium, which is really unusual because most mycelium, you know, you have Psilocybe cubensis mycelium, you put a drop of oil on there, it just sits on top. But Pleurotus, it sucks in immediately and then it kills the mycelium. So you have a dead spot in your petri dish. But then after about 6 months, it eventually does eat the mycelium. So it comes back. So you can eat oil with oyster mushrooms, but the oil has to be at a very low concentration. So if you just try to clean up an oil spill with oyster mushrooms, you're not really going to get anywhere with that. So it's probably not a practical thing for breaking down oil. It's probably better to like fractionally distill and recycle the oil that's recovered from oil spills. But, you know, as time goes on, there's a lot of different groups that are doing micro-remediation stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of study and a lot of interest. And maybe one day we will find a practical use for micro-remediation. I think the easiest path to that is to take the spent blocks from a commercial mushroom growing operation because they already have all this mycelium being produced and it's still alive when they're done fruiting it for commercial production. So you can take this and use it to stabilize soils, use it as compost, things like that. And you're not burning a whole lot of oil and wasting a whole bunch of energy to produce this mycelium because it's already being produced for food. So I think the most practical way to do micro-remediation is going to be using the spent blocks from commercial edibles operations.
Thanks, Alan. I really appreciate that. I'm glad that you elaborated a little bit more on what was talked about earlier and introduced. And yeah, you hit the nail on the head. Right now, we're working with the knowledge that we know. And also what we touched upon is that mycology is still very understudied. So the more people that we get excited and introduced into these concepts, the more knowledge that we're going to retain and the more practical it's going to be. So it's very promising and really happy that you were on the show. Really happy that Maria, you're on the show. And sadly, Jasper couldn't finish out the show with us, but it was so great having everybody here and putting together a really good show for information. And hopefully we inspire some people out there to take on mycology, whether it's professionally or whether you're just excited about it, want to be an amateur and send beautiful substances to Alan to continue to add to taxonomy. So I feel like we could go on for hours, but I think this is good enough for one podcast. Maybe we can do something in the future. And like I said, great having you on. My mind's blown. I'm going to be rewatching this whenever I get the chance. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
It is nice talking to you both, Sam and Maria.
That is all for this episode of Woke Talk Podcast. Now I'd like to give a big shout out to my guest stars for sharing their wealth of knowledge and vast expertise. I would also love to mention my amazing team here at Woke Talk Podcast for their collective efforts to make this show happen. Also, we are actively looking for someone who would take over our social media marketing. If you're interested or know someone who may be interested, please reach out to us at woketalkpodcast@gmail.com or DM us on any of our social media platforms. So to wrap up, we hope you take away important information in regards to mycology, but what we truly hope is that we sparked some of your curiosity to pursue mycology either as an academic or an amateur for conservation, medicinal, or other consumption purposes. To find out more information about mycology, please take advantage of Jasper's community called the Fungi Academy. You can find the Fungi Academy on social media or their website, www.fungiacademy.com. You can also view Alan's work on inaturalist.org or mushroomobserver.org. Or to make things super easy, look up Alan Rockefeller on YouTube and you can watch many of his talks on the subject of mycology. Once again, thank you all for listening to Woke Talk Podcast. I am your host, Sam Stanford. And as always, stay woke.
Woke Talk Podcast would like to give a shout out to Anchor by Spotify for sponsoring our podcast, along with Ben Sound Music for providing our show with intro, outro, and advertisement background rhythm.